Good evening. I'm William Brangham.
And I'm Amna Nawaz in Uvalde, Texas. On the NewsHour tonight, a community reflects on the first anniversary of the elementary school shooting that left 19 children and two teachers dead. What's changed and what hasn't since that fateful day?
The economic risks from a potential government default rise as Congress and the White House struggle to reach an agreement to raise the debt ceiling.
And a Philadelphia organization works to mentor black teachers to counteract dropout rates among black students.
39% less likely to drop out of high school and up to 29% more likely to go to college if they have a single black teacher. Why isn't this the intervention that we're leading with?
Welcome to the NewsHour. This week marks 1 year since the mass shooting at Robb Elementary School, where a gunman killed 19 children and two teachers.
William, here in Uvalde, it's a community still very much trying to make sense of exactly what happened a year ago. Family members who lost loved ones have been pushing for accountability and more action from their elected officials. Most folks here say that they just don't have answers to their questions.
Amna, you were there a year ago reporting on this massacre. What is it like now, a year later, as they're approaching this anniversary?
William, we all remember a year ago, this was a community very much united, right? United certainly in their grief, mourning the loss of those 19 children and two adults, united in their shock that this could happen, something like this could happen here, and also in their anger, not only at the teenage gunman who carried out the rampage, but at the police response, which you'll remember fueled national outrage when we learned about those excruciating 77 minutes when heavily armed police officers failed to go into the classroom, even as children inside were calling 911 and some lay dying. Even today, as Robb Elementary, the school itself, has been shut down and shuttered, there are signs of that grief everywhere you look in this community. Memorials like the one behind me here, which still stand today, people who walk around with Uvalde Strong tattoos, but also murals, huge building-side murals dedicated to each of the 21 people killed in that attack. We actually spoke to a muralist named Abel Ortiz, who's one of the artists behind some of those murals, and asked him about marking this day 1 year later.
If there's any art in the world that I wish didn't exist, would be these murals. Because that means that children would be alive, the teachers would be alive. Uvalde would be the normal town it was before. But now they have to exist because it's a way to remember their names and remember their faces, but also to bring about hopefully maybe change.
We also spoke to Tammy Sinclair. She's an archivist at Uvalde's library, where they are now, have been receiving and are now keeping some 10,000 different pieces of memorabilia and gifts and letters that poured into this community over the last year. She read us just a portion of one of those letters they received from North Carolina. Take a listen.
Know you are loved and supported during this challenging time. Know you are loved, rest in peace, dream your sweet dreams until your soul is released.
William, it's fair to say 1 year later, this is a community that has been forever changed by the events.
Amna, as you mentioned earlier, there have been attempts at accountability. Where do those efforts stand?
You know, we've heard this from a number of families here who remain very frustrated by what they say is a lack of transparency and information from their elected officials and police officials in particular. They told us many times they hear about developments through the news media or through social media itself. There are some investigations. The Uvalde District Attorney has launched a probe into the police response. We know the Department of Justice has also launched its own inquiry. There was a senior Department of Justice official named Vanita Gupta who was just here last month to meet with families. But so far, no criminal charges have been filed, and families say they want more accountability. There is a divide here, though. There are members of this community who believe it is time to move on 1 year later. And similarly, there's a divide over how to handle gun violence. This is an area where gun rights are highly valued. It's a big hunting community. And while the families of those who lost loved ones have been pushing to raise the purchase age limit from 18 to 21 for those assault-style weapons like the one used in the attack, that effort failed in the state legislature. And quite frankly, many people here don't support that kind of effort. You have to remember, William, just a few months after the shooting, the majority of residents here in Uvalde County actually voted to put Governor Greg Abbott, Texas governor, back into office for a third term. He, of course, has long opposed any kind of gun violence reform. William?
Tomorrow, as you well know, is the actual anniversary. What is your understanding of how the city is going to commemorate that day?
Well, schools here have been closed all week. We also must remember for the many who lost someone that day, there are many, many more who survived, children who were in the school and had to flee, parents who are similarly traumatized by the events of that day. Many families we talked to said they were going to leave town this week because they didn't want to be here for this anniversary. We know there's a big vigil tomorrow evening as well, and even that has been largely pushed and organized by the families of those who lost someone on that day. This is another divide that we're seeing among those who feel they should move on and those who don't want to forget. In fact, local officials here issued a statement in advance of the anniversary asking people not to come to Uvalde, saying we ask you to respect the community and stay away. But the families of those who lost loved ones issued their own statement welcoming people to come join them here and saying we don't want the world to forget. William.
Amna, thank you so much for being there. I know we'll hear more from you tomorrow. In the day's other headlines, Illinois' Attorney General reported that the sexual abuse of children by Roman Catholic clergy in the state was far more extensive than previously known. The investigation found 451 clerics sexually abused nearly 2,000 children between 1950 and 2019. That is four times more clergy members than the church had previously disclosed, although many of these cases are now too old to prosecute.
These perpetrators may never be held accountable in a court of law. But by naming them in this report, the intention is to provide the public with accountability, public accountability, and a measure of healing to survivors who have long suffered in silence.
The report also charged that Catholic dioceses failed to confront accused clergy and failed to warn parishioners. A judge in New York today set former President Trump's criminal trial for next March 25th in the thick of the presidential primary season. Mr. Trump is running again, and he threw up his hands in frustration as he heard the news. He appeared by video link to go over an order that bars him from using evidence in the hush money case to attack witnesses. If he violates that order, he could be held in contempt of court. A Russian court has ordered Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gerskovich to be held for another 3 months. He was arrested in March and accused of espionage. The Journal and the Biden administration have denied that claim. Gerskovich appeared at an April hearing, but today's session was not announced, and the U.S. State Department has said it's being denied regular contact with him.
We once again call on Russia to comply with their obligation to provide consular access to him. The claims against Evan are baseless, and we continue to call for his immediate release as well as for the immediate release of Paul Whelan.
Whelan is a retired U.S. Marine who is serving a 16-year sentence for espionage in Russia. The U.S. denies that charge as well. Meanwhile, Russia's military claimed it defeated a cross-border raid from Ukraine, killing more than 70 attackers. Moscow said Ukrainian soldiers carried out the raid in the Belgorod region. Kyiv said they were Russian dissidents. Today, an anti-Kremlin group released video of fighters driving in what purported to be Russian territory. They said, quote, "One day we will return to stay." The people of Guam today battened down for what could be the most powerful storm to hit the U.S. territory in decades. Forecasters said Super Typhoon Mawar intensified as it headed for a possible direct hit from the southeast. Palm trees swayed in the rising winds hours before the storm's expected landfall. In a recorded message, the governor warned that only buildings made of concrete will be safe.
Mawar is bordering a Category 4 typhoon with winds up to 150 miles per hour. Please take action now and evacuate in anticipation of strengthening winds and the likelihood of flooding. We must act now to ensure the protection of our people and your safety.
Here in Washington, President Biden approved an emergency declaration to mobilize federal aid and recovery operations once the storm passes. U.S. Park Police have arrested a man who crashed his rental truck near the White House last night. Officials say it may have been intentional. The 19-year-old from Missouri faces multiple charges, including threatening the president. Amateur video showed the truck driving into a barrier at Lafayette Square in front of the White House. Investigators said they found a Nazi flag inside the vehicle. And on Wall Street, stocks gave ground as the debt ceiling talks in Washington showed no clear progress. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 231 points to close at 33,055. The NASDAQ fell 160 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 was also down more than 1%. Still to come on the NewsHour, an on-the-ground look at the human toll from the battle for Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine. The Los Angeles Dodgers reinvite a satirical LGBTQ group to Pride Night after widespread backlash. A tenuous ceasefire in Sudan offers some needed relief. And a boundary-pushing artist discusses her new installation.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
If you stacked up the full debt of the United States in $100 bills, you could make not one, not two, but 13 piles of cash as tall as the Washington Monument. Lisa Desjardins takes a step back from the debt ceiling negotiations on Capitol Hill to account for what the nation owes.
Okay, the national debt, all of the money the U.S. government owes, is currently at $31.4 trillion. But what does that mean?
For one, that's decades worth of government spending. Things like Medicaid and other health care, the U.S. military, food stamps and other benefits, fixing roads, Head Start and schools, the environment, national parks, and 1,000 other areas.
It's simple. For years, what the U.S. government spent on those things was far greater than the amount of money it had brought in to pay for them. That stacked up to that $31.4 trillion in debt we have now. That's an enormous, almost nonsensical number. So let's put it a different way. If all Americans pitched in, it would take $94,000 from each one of us, every man, woman, and child, to pay off the national debt.
The U.S. national debt in dollars is by far the largest in the world. But we also have the largest economy in the world. And that's how most experts approach this.
Think of it this way. The national debt is a weight, sometimes a heavy weight, like a barbell at a gym. But what matters is not just the size of the debt, but the size of the economy or person trying to handle that debt. So how big is our debt compared to the economy trying to hold it up?
Back in the year 2000, it was a relatively easy lift. The debt equaled just 36% of the combined earnings, goods, and everything the U.S. economy produced that year. But it shot up, and now the U.S. is shouldering a national debt that is 98% of what we will produce this year. And much worse, if nothing changes, in 30 years, the debt is forecast to soar, to be nearly twice as large as everything the economy produces, a potentially overwhelming weight for the U.S. economy.
As the debt keeps creeping up, we just are placing a greater and greater burden on the next generation.
Michael Peterson is CEO of the Peterson Foundation, a nonprofit group focused on the U.S. budget long term. And he's particularly worried about the cost of the debt.
The interest cost is really what is the cost of the debt. If you think over a long period of time, by about 2050, approximately 50% of federal revenues will go towards interest only.
That means by 2053, when little kids today are in their 30s, the interest costs on the national debt will be the largest expenditure the federal government has. And 50%, half of the taxes that these guys pay, will go to those interest costs.
That will constrict funding for everything, including what we mentioned earlier, healthcare, the military, food stamps, education, and the environment. Even Social Security benefits would be significantly cut.
There is still time to change course and multiple ways to address the debt, but the longer lawmakers wait to tackle it, the deeper and more painful future cuts and the future burden will be. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
In just the time it took Lisa to tell that story, the U.S. slipped nearly $10 million deeper into debt. And each passing second brings the country closer to a first-ever default. Lisa has spent the day chasing down lawmakers, and she now joins us to bring us up to speed. Lisa, a terrific report on the debt there. But back to these talks on Capitol Hill. We are right at the precipice here. What is the current status of negotiations?
We're getting close. As you said, I was on the Hill with our producer, Kyle Medora. This is where we are. Talks are at a standstill at this moment. In fact, Speaker McCarthy earlier today said talks had broken down. Really, there is some agreement over many areas, but they are not making any distance over two big areas. That is work requirements, which Republicans want to add more of for some benefits. And then the other one, here you see the White House lawmakers coming in for the morning meeting. Republicans also say they are just, there's Speaker McCarthy, simply too far apart when it comes to spending and funding. One dynamic we've seen today, William, is Speaker McCarthy again and again coming and talking to reporters. Republicans feel like they're winning the sort of public argument here. We're seeing Democrats just starting to speak to us more. But I think right now the House is expected to recess on Thursday with no deal. And I think this weekend we could still be talking about this.
Well, you, I know, in addition to all your other reporting, have some reporting about what the Treasury Department might be doing in case we get to this dreaded moment. What is that?
Sources familiar have confirmed that the U.S. Treasury has sent out notices to government agencies asking them to hold off on any payments that don't have specific due dates right now. Something that maybe pro forma or just kind of happenstance, they were sending out these payments, but they can wait. They have a deadline that they don't have to meet. They're saying hold back on that. The U.S. Treasury essentially trying to hold on to some kind of cushion of cash because it is getting concerned that we're close to the deadline and it may come down to a few $100 million, which is usually not a lot for the U.S. Treasury, but could make a big difference in these negotiations.
Lisa Desjardins, as always, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So the impact of the U.S. defaulting on its debt or not paying its bills would be felt immediately by many Americans. We don't know precisely where the axe would fall, but it could include suspension of Social Security checks or a loss of food stamp benefits, to name just a few. Beyond that, many economists argue it could also be devastating to financial markets, potentially tipping the country into a recession and creating economic turmoil globally. Mark Zandi is the chief economist at Moody's Analytics, and he's been keeping a very close eye on these concerns. He testified before Congress about them, and he joins us now. Mark Zandi, thank you so much for being here. What is your sense of confidence about whether or not a deal is going to be reached?
Well, William, logic dictates that they'll reach an agreement. A lot of drama, Sturm und Drang, but, when it gets down to the last minute here, I expect them to come through and pass a piece of legislation increasing the limit. But having said that, I've seen many debt limit battles over the years. This one feels potentially different. The politics are different. And as such, it's not a non-zero probability that lawmakers make a mistake here and breach the debt limit. So we can't rule that out.
Speaker McCarthy says that just looking at the calendar, they have to strike a deal in the next couple of days in order to make the trains run on time. The markets have shown some concern over this, but not that much. Do you think that there is enough fire being applied to the feet of the people on Capitol Hill?
Not enough. I mean, it's a bit perplexing. I have not heard the pounding on the doors that, I typically have in past debt limit dramas from business people, from donors, from voters. From the markets. I mean, take a look at the stock market. It's kind of hung in there really very well. No sign of any angst among stock investors, which makes me a bit nervous, right? Because I do think it takes that pounding on the door to kind of light the fire, to generate the political will, to get lawmakers to make this tough vote. And the fact that we're not seeing that makes me nervous. Now, I suspect as we get closer and closer to that so-called X date, when the Treasury can't make all the payments, then markets will react and, we'll get that pressure. But so far, the people are not as anxious as I thought they would be at this point in time.
Let's say that they don't meet that deal. What happens in the days and the weeks immediately afterwards?
Well, it's a mess, progressively worse mess as hours and days go by. You know, I think it is important to recognize, though, I don't think the Treasury would default on the debt. They have the ability to pay bondholders. It's a separate accounting system, payment system, and they could get that done. Because they know if they don't pay on the debt, that would be like words like catastrophic would be appropriate, just a complete, utter fiasco. But they would stop making payments on all other bills, and everyone would get their money from the government later and later and later, depending on how long this went. And of course, investors would be very anxious as well. Even though they're getting paid, they're going to say, hey, you know, look, they're willing to breach this go around. What about next time and the time after and the time after that? You, the taxpayer, have to pay me more in higher interest to compensate for that risk. So the damage would start to accumulate pretty quickly. Within a few days, I think it would be so significant that given how weak the economy already is coming into this, we'd be in recession.
Do you think that your firm, Moody's, and others would, as has happened in the past, downgrade the U.S.'s credit rating? And I guess my question is really the long-term reputational harm that this seems like it would do to the United States standing.
Well, if you every rating agency is different in terms of their methodology and approach. I mean, if you read what they're writing publicly, I think it would take a default on the debt to actually get a downgrade, at least initially. I mean, if the breach extended on for more than a week or two, given the turmoil, they would be under pressure to downgrade at that point. But you make a great point, William. Yeah, downgrade or no downgrade, the fact that we, the United States of America, can't pay our bills on time, and you know we have done that since the founding of our nation. The fact that we can't get that done, it will have a big impact on people's trust and faith in us. And I can't understate more how important that is. That is critical to keeping interest rates down here, allowing us to invest and be the global engine of economic growth, and not only economically, but geopolitically. And we would significantly diminish that by going down that dark path if we did breach.
You warned about all of this and the coming storm as early as January of this year. When you see how close we are to the precipice now, does it surprise you how far we have gotten to the edge?
No. I mean, I've done this for a long time. I've seen this go right down to the edge every single time. So, and you know, it's the politics of it. There is a aspect of it that's very performative, theater. There's folks on either side of the aisle here, way on the other side of the aisle, that need to be accommodated so that you can get enough votes to get a piece of legislation, and that does require the drama. So I'm not surprised, but I am. Each time that we come down to the wire, I get increasingly more nervous, and my level of angst is now starting to grow. I suspect we're going to come back, in the next few days, certainly after Memorial Day, and lawmakers will strike a deal. But it just feels very uncomfortable. And it goes to a broader point. This is no way to run a railroad. I mean, this debt limit thing is not at all productive. It's highly counterproductive. We need to figure out a way to get rid of it.
All right. Mark Zandi of Moody's Analytics, thank you so much for being here.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Russia now claims it has won the battle for Bakhmut, but the fighting continues. Both sides have taken massive casualties to control the symbolic but strategically marginal city in the east of Ukraine. John Ray of Independent Television News has this rare look from inside one of Ukraine's military field hospitals. And the note of caution, images and accounts in this story could well disturb some viewers.
Its location is secret, because in the battle for Bakhmut, even this medical post is under fire. A fragile haven of humanity amid carnage. We watch as doctors fight to save a soldier. Half his face has been ripped away by shrapnel. All you have to do is breathe, says a doctor. He tells him, if you panic, you're dead. There are more casualties than ever, sometimes too many to treat at once.
You know, I am a doctor. I am not God.
This is Kaplia, one of Ukraine's top trauma specialists, who leads a team of frontline medics.
Sometimes I have operated on a soldier who should really have no chance to live, but somehow they survive. That inspires me.
The soldier's name is Anatoly. He's 31 years old, and for a while, his fate seems to hang in the balance. As shells begin to land, so too does the safety of the medical unit. Ukraine's artillery, close by, fires back. Members of the team were injured when a Russian rocket landed outside the door. Dmitry says it's a constant danger.
Back and forth, yeah? You fire, Russians fire.
Ukraine does not reveal the number of its soldiers killed and injured, but the discarded, bloodied uniforms reflect the intensity of fighting in Bakhmut. This commander tells me that in the city his unit has been bombarded for 3 hours non-stop. One of his men lies on the treatment table. A shell exploded beneath him. He cannot move his legs.
When you witness scenes like this, it's impossible not to think about the bloodshed, the sacrifice, and the loss of life. But for these medics, I suppose the operating table itself is a kind of battlefield with its own defeats and victories.
The paramedics here risk their own lives, ranging across the battlefield to save others.
So why do you do this?
Because it's my country.
That's your country?
Yes, it's my country. I would like that this country, my country, stay on the map of the world.
As for Anatoly, his condition is now stable.
Will he be okay? Will he be okay?
Yeah. I feel good.
You feel good?
Yeah.
Okay. He's taken to a hospital, safe from the front line, alive. But he will bear the scars of Bakhmut forever.
The latest company caught up in the battle over LGBTQ issues is the Los Angeles Dodgers. One of baseball's most storied franchises, the Dodgers originally planned to include one particular queer and trans group as part of its Pride event. But then, under pressure from critics, the Dodgers retracted that invitation. Now, as Stephanie Tsai reports, the team has reversed course again, apologized, and welcomed the group back.
The Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence are a charity and drag group calling attention to LGBTQ plus issues. Not only were they invited to the Dodgers Pride Night, the franchise originally planned to honor the group with its Community Heroes Award next month. But conservative Catholics have called the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence a hate group, and a local diocese called the group's behavior demeaning and disrespectful to the Sisters of the Catholic Church. The Dodgers reacted by rescinding the group's invite. A member defended the charity.
They've always said that we're anti-Catholic and that we're making fun of Catholicism, which is not true. We are here to be silly and to look flamboyant in service to people in our community who have no resources, no money, no voice.
With the organizers of the Los Angeles Pride Parade threatening to pull out of Pride Night, the Dodgers have now done another 180. Yesterday, the team apologized and re-invited the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. It's the latest example of a corporation facing fallout for trying to be LGBTQ plus inclusive. Last month, right-wing boycotts of Bud Light like these flooded social media after trans actress and influencer Dylan Mulvaney posted this on her Instagram.
This month, I celebrated my day 365 of womanhood, and Bud Light sent me possibly the best gift ever, a can with my face on it.
In the fallout, the brand took a hit in sales, and two top marketing executives took a leave of absence. Anheuser-Busch said it would refocus marketing on sports and music.
For another perspective, I'm joined by LZ Granderson, columnist for the LA Times. LZ, it's good to see you. I should say you're also a veteran sports journalist, and you've reported for years on professional sports' move toward more inclusivity of gay athletes. So did the Dodgers strike out, so to speak, on this one, at least initially?
In using their own words, yes. I had an interview with the president of the Dodgers, Stan Kasten, and he flat out said that they made a mistake, and he explained why. That they're an organization that have done these sort of celebrations for 10 years without any hitch. And then this year they had a hitch and they didn't know what to do and they panicked. But they had meetings with the community, with the LGBTQ plus community leaders, with the sisters, and they decided to re-invite them, returning back to their overall sort of theme, which is the organization supports the community.
What was the original sin, so to speak, here by the Dodgers in your view? Was it rescinding the invitation? I mean, at what point did they go wrong?
I think they went wrong assuming that they could operate the same way they've been operating for the past 10 years, to be quite honest with you. And that's not just a commentary in regards to the Dodgers, but really as much of corporate America. You know, as I said earlier, the Dodgers have been doing this for 10 years. Well, go back 10 years ago, we had a different president. We had a different Supreme Court. We had a different sense in the culture. Things have changed over the past decade. And so it's very difficult to try to wade into waters that's dealing with groups, whether it's with conversations of diversity and equity and inclusion, whether it's about trans rights, et cetera. Anything that's seen as progressive can be used against your corporations. And so it's really hoof upon, you know, not a lot of corporations to look to see what happened to Disney, to see what happens with Bud Light, to see what happened with the Dodgers, and be prepared with statements and a philosophy. So when the criticism comes, you're not scrambling like those organizations I just mentioned.
LZ, in the context of legislation being passed lately by conservative states to specifically target trans people, do you think the Dodgers' decision to now include the Sisters of Indulgence charity is more poignant?
Well, I think that it's just more consistent to what they've always tried to be, particularly during Pride celebrations, which is to celebrate all aspects of the community. I think that it's a little, I think it puts too much credit, to be quite honest with you, to the conservative movement that's attacking the trans movement right now, because it isn't really a well thought out plan. It's really just another example of throwing anything up against the wall and seeing what sticks. And for this particular news cycle, this particular political cycle, it is attacking again the queer community. But we've seen other examples of them trying to find a cultural touchstone that can help drive voters, right? So this isn't unique. It isn't about the Dodgers trying to make a statement with the sisters. They've always been supportive of the drag community, just like all aspects of the queer community. This is, again, just about a lightning in the bottle moment in terms of where we are politically, and that the Dodgers are just doing what they've always done, which is try to be an organization for everyone, including the queer community.
So the political lightning rod that are trans issues in particular, like right now, aside, LZ, there are people who are offended by this group and what they view as mocking of Catholicism and its figures, including Christ and Virgin Mary. You heard that criticism coming from outside politicians and groups, as you mentioned, but did you also hear that from Dodgers fans?
We've heard a lot, actually, from Dodgers fans. There, you know, if you go online, anyone can just simply take a look at some of the commentary that's happening on social media today. And there are a lot of people who are upset about the sisters' inclusion and who were actually happy that the Dodgers, you know, decided to initially disinvite them. That's just going to be a reality for anyone who decides to try to do anything that's remotely tied to the culture, because we're just in a very divisive moment right now in this country. And anything, whether you're talking about Black History Month, where you're celebrating AAPI Month, you're going to find a group that's going to find some level of offense. And I would just say that, you know, when it comes specifically to religious ideology and imagery, you know, you can go back to Rosemary Baby in the 1970s, and I believe the Catholic Church was upset about that. You can go back to Madonna and Papa Don't Preach, and they were upset in the 80s about that. And so there's been consistent examples in which people have used religion imagery to try to have a cultural moment, maybe a satirical moment, and that people of that faith have been offended by it. This is not unique to the sisters. This is not unique to the Dodgers. This is something that we've witnessed in this culture for many decades.
Certainly a conversation that continues in many quarters. LZ Granderson, a columnist for the Los Angeles Times, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
In our series on higher education this spring, we've looked at why it's crucial to build out and diversify the teaching pipeline. Tonight, we focus on why developing and recruiting more Black teachers is especially important for Black students to make sure they continue their education and finish their degrees. Jeff Bennett has the story for our series, Rethinking College.
All right, if you are in group six, you're coming to me now.
Time for reading lessons in Lee Datt's second grade class at Mastery Prep Elementary in North Philadelphia.
Remember, read to comprehend. Let me hear that again. Read to comprehend.
Read to comprehend.
It's a common scene in classrooms across the country, except for one key difference.
What did we talk about the last time I saw y'all?
The teacher.
Nationally, there are less than 2% of all public school teachers are Black men.
Sharif El-Mekki is the CEO of the Center for Black Educator Development. He says teachers like Lee Datz are all too rare.
Even in places like Philadelphia that is extremely diverse and about half of the student population are Black, it hovers between 4 and 5% every year.
And yet, studies show for young Black students, having a teacher who looks like them has huge long-term benefits.
Students in kindergarten to first grade, if they experience at least one Black teacher, they are less likely to drop out of high school and more likely to enroll in college.
Constance Lindsay is an assistant professor at the UNC School of Education, whose research focuses on educational equity.
What in your research has surprised you the most?
I think the outsized impacts on Black boys. Across several of our studies, we find that many times the results are driven by persistently low-income young Black boys, so it's really important for them.
What sound does IR make?
So the stakes, she says, are highest in these classrooms where most of the students are Black and also come from economically disadvantaged families, especially for the boys.
39% less likely to drop out of high school and up to 29% more likely to go to college if they have a single Black teacher. Why isn't this the intervention that we're leading with? What are you doing this summer?
Sharif El-Mekki, a former principal and teacher himself, is on a mission.
You can go on weneedblackteachers.com and just see, we'd love to have you. It's a paid apprenticeship, it's a job.
El-Mekki Center for Black Educator Development is building a Black teacher pipeline. One component, paid apprenticeships at Freedom School's Literacy Academy, where high school and college students get hands-on teaching experience.
Don't go to McDonald's and Starbucks. Come work here if you're interested in becoming a teacher.
Good morning, Freedom Schools!
Good morning!
This summer, we'll have almost 200 Black and brown teacher apprentices working and leading hundreds of first, second, and third graders.
At first, I really didn't like kids.
Teaching was not an obvious career path for high school junior Joshua McQueen.
I used to be scared of them, actually. It was like, because he made me so nervous because he has so much energy and stuff like that.
But when McQueen apprenticed last summer, he says one student gave him a new perspective.
Like, say if we went out to recess, I'll be playing tag with them and basketball with all of them. He would be the one that was, like, constantly playing just because I was playing. And it made me, like, realize the impact that I can have on kids' life.
How can you even picture yourself in the shoes of excellence when you don't see yourself?
McQueen is now taking a course his high school offers on the history and culture of Black teachers.
Often, when teachers are being prepared to teach, everything is centered in a white historical lens. 80% of our public school teachers are white, and then they're sent into predominantly Black and brown classrooms.
Two clap on three, one, two, three. One more time, two clap on three, one, two, three. Here we go, chapter
Amir
five.
Williams is an education major at Westchester University.
I've always wanted to be a teacher since I was 5 years old. I've loved school my entire life. I look at it as sort of a calling.
So when you guys are writing your own sentences, I want your sentences to convey what that word means.
Twice a week, Williams' student teaches fifth graders at James Road School in the West Philadelphia neighborhood where he grew up.
I think that a lot of times people have misconceptions of West Philadelphia students, or just urban students in general, that they won't amount to much. They aren't scholars, they can't learn. But I grew up in this neighborhood and I'm in college. I wanted to sort of just come back and prove that, like, students that come from urban schools can go on to do amazing, great things.
Who was described as obedient in the book?
Williams receives scholarship money through the Black teacher pipeline to support his education. Once he gets to 5 years of teaching, he'll get a retention bonus.
What kind of impact do you think you have on your students?
I think that they see me and they see someone that looks like them in a professional position. They see that, like, I can do that one day. Actually, one of my students said, like, I want to be like you, Mr. Williams, one day. And that sort of just, like, first it melted my heart, but also sort of gave me, like, even more fire to do this work, especially in a profession where so many doubts come with it. You know, not a lot of pay, a lot of stress, a lot of duties, but things like that sort of, like, reel you back in.
Constance Lindsay says educators like Williams are influential role models.
Seeing a college-educated black person might sort of put a spark in you to attend college later on.
Lindsay cites another reason why black instructors can be so impactful.
My colleagues actually have a study where they show that black teachers, on average, expect black students to go farther.
That's the case with second grade teacher Trent Petty.
I always tell my kids, you can be the one taking care of me in 10 years. You can be my doctor, my lawyer, my mayor, my president.
The expectations are high because I believe in you.
Lee Datz acknowledges his students tell him he's a lot because he expects so much from them.
I always tell them I'm looking for you to be an Ivy League student because it's easy to just give up on a child. It really is. It's a natural thing to have a day where they're off task and they're doing this, they're doing that, and they're black and brown. Or you can believe in them and believe in their dream and hope and desire and hold on to that.
What did Ruby Bridges have to deal with?
Datz feels an obligation to teach his students about their shared history and culture.
What does segregation have to do with being bullied? I don't understand. Aaliyah.
In our classroom, anybody who we learn about that's African American, I really try to make it vocal to understand the importance of what they had to go through. Like understanding your background, understanding your history.
I imagine all teachers feel a sense of responsibility. I would also imagine that you feel that even more, given that you are a black man in a school, predominantly black school.
My natural responsibility is just to show what a black and brown teacher looks like. Like if you never have another one, you know you have one.
In the long run, that could make all the difference.
What did she have to do when she was your age?
After weeks of brutal fighting, a ceasefire is supposed to have started last night in Sudan. It was brokered by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and signed by leaders of the two army factions who have been at war with each other for control of the third largest country in Africa. The ongoing conflict has killed hundreds, injured more than 5,000, and sent nearly a million people fleeing to neighboring countries. Millions more have been trapped in their homes, unable to access basic services or healthcare. To better understand what's happening now, we turn to Halud Kerr. She's a Sudanese policy and political analyst and founding director of the Confluence Advisory, which is a think tank based in Sudan. Halud, thank you so much for being here. Could you just give us a status report? This is now the seventh ceasefire that has been agreed to. Is this current one holding as far as you can tell?
Well, we're getting some mixed reports. Overall, it seems like there is more calm than there has been during the other ceasefires. But we are hearing reports of intense fighting in some areas. So what it looks like is that the fighting has been scaled down, which is, you know, no mean feat and is something to be thankful for. But at the same time, we haven't seen a total ceasefire. The other six ceasefires that have preceded this one have not held because there was no or else. As part of the agreement, it was, you know, pretty please, would you stop fighting? What we're seeing this time around is that the U.S., who helped broker the ceasefire, is saying that it is prepared to use, for example, sanctions to enforce a ceasefire. But as yet, we don't have an idea of what that will look like.
You were in Khartoum when the fighting first broke out back in the spring, and you've since been able to get out. What has Sudan's life been like in these weeks of this conflict?
What this war has done in a matter of weeks is completely annihilate Sudanese political, social, and economic life. There is, you know, people haven't been earning a wage for April and now for May, likely too. There's not enough money to go around. Where there is, people can't afford to buy what's in the shops. Sudan is a net importer of goods and hasn't been able to get goods into the city, including some agricultural products. And so we're looking at the city, particularly Khartoum, being on the brink of starvation.
I mean, what you're describing in certain parts of the country is an obvious humanitarian disaster. We know that, I believe it's 25 million people need humanitarian aid. The UN has asked for several billion dollars, but yet we are also seeing reports of different factions attacking aid groups and destroying, you know, hijacking their convoys, destroying their medical supplies. Given the need in the country, can you help us understand why these warring factions would be attacking the very people who are there to help?
Well, they would like an advantage, and any advantage right now in terms of supply, particularly medical equipment, would be vital. And they would rather compile all of the aid coming in, particularly health aid and food aid for their own troops. Now, we understood that this was going to be the case, that despite the dire humanitarian situation, both sides would politicize the aid.
I understand that there have been accusations of war crimes on both sides here. Could you just tell us a little bit of the kinds of crimes that we have seen allegations of?
Well, both sides have been committing crimes, but it looks different depending on which faction we're talking about. So for the paramilitary rapid support forces, they have been looting people's homes. There have been allegations and evidence of sexual assault. There have been abductions, forced abductions. For the Sudan Armed Forces, which is the official army, there have been accusations, again, evidenced of aerial bombardments of, for example, hospitals, schools, and other public buildings that are protected by international humanitarian law. Now, the Sudan Armed Forces says that they are bombing these buildings because they've been taken over by the paramilitary forces. And because of the way that this has effectively been a race to the bottom, we are likely to see the rate of atrocities go through the roof. Already we're seeing in parts of Darfur, which you'll remember has been through 20 years of conflict, we're already seeing atrocities ratcheting up there, particularly in the east, in the western part of Darfur.
On this issue of accountability, you touched on this before, but given that there is no seeming mechanism to hold either of these sides accountable for their crimes, for all of these things that you are describing, is there any sense that this conflict can truly be brought to an end anytime soon?
The leverage lies elsewhere. The leverage lies with their partners in the region, their supporters in the region, Egypt for the Sudan Armed Forces and the United Arab Emirates for the Rapid Support Forces, respectively. Is the United States willing to, and other actors, are they willing to, sacrifice some political cachet and force some of their regional allies, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and others, for the sake of Sudan's continued peace and peace and stability? That is the core question. If the answer is yes, we may see some traction. Until then, I'm afraid this looks like it's going to be a protracted conflict.
All right, Halud Kheir of the Confluence Advisory, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, William.
Photos, videos, objects, sounds, and light. The myriad stuff, both real and virtual, in our daily lives. It's all the material for Sarah Z, an artist who takes this information overload and gives it a new shape. Jeffrey Brown takes a look for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
At New York's Guggenheim Museum right now, you can walk around and into an artwork by Sarah Z and be taken by more than a few surprises.
This is your studio ladder?
I know, that wasn't on purpose, but I didn't peel it off. We didn't have time.
Oh, so studio ladder, yes. Pliers,
yes.
Houseplant. I mean, I can just go on and on.
Yeah, yeah.
But anything goes, in a sense.
So anything goes, but, you know, everything is necessary.
In art terms, Z's works are installations or sculptures. More colorfully, some have seen an exploded hardware store, or the contents of an iPhone spilled out into space, all the millions of images in our lives turned into objects, pieces of constructions that may hold together but may break apart.
I like dismantling the artwork and having it seep into the architecture, the audience, seep into each other, so these boundaries, these frames, they get blurred, because I think that's the way we're experiencing life. You know, we can walk down the street and watch a movie, you know, so we're looking up at the sky and then we're looking down and then we're seeing a person. And so that intersection of the way we experience time, the way we experience space is changing. And I'm interested in how we mark what is important, what is meaningful with this new language.
The exhibition is titled Time Lapse, and in some works, like one called Timekeeper, the references to marking time are overt. A metronome, clocks in different cities, set amid a kind of giant science experiment of objects, small projectors, videos, sounds, lights. There's a different way to experience time in Time Zero. A large abstract painting and a strange mirror version of it cut into pieces and reassembled beneath the original. Everywhere you turn in her work, images of images. It might be on our screens, on our walks, or in our heads.
The number of images that are around us, it becomes, the volume on that has turned so high that the images that are in our head, which happen while we're dreaming, while we're imagining, while we're hoping. When I look at you, I can picture like seeing you on television. That's in my head. So I'm seeing these images at the same time. You know, interior images are being merged all the time with exterior images. So that's something I'm interested in people thinking about.
Z, now 54, grew up in Boston. Her Chinese-born father, an architect, her mother, a schoolteacher. She's received a MacArthur Fellowship, represented the U.S. at the 2013 Venice Biennale, completed major commissions in public spaces such as New York's LaGuardia Airport and Highline Park, and is exhibited in museums around the world. At the Guggenheim, she's created site-specific works that play off and with Frank Lloyd Wright's landmark architectural spiral, the curved bays where art is exhibited, and the sloping ramps that can disorient viewers.
You can see, actually, you know, how off balance we are. Usually things like this would be covered up in the museum, but I wanted you to really see, like, this is the first step to leveling the piece, so you can really understand that even your body is always at an angle at this space.
Uh-huh.
And then when you move around,
I mean, so we see the arc, we see the construction.
Exactly. It's not hidden. Nothing is hidden.
She's also offered new sight lines of the spectacular oculus at the top of the dome and hung a pendulum that descends to a small fountain in the atrium. And she's filled the space with everyday objects, including appliances. Materials you're more likely to find at Home Depot or in your own home than in a museum.
I think of material as a palette of daily life.
Palette of daily life.
I'm interested in the line being blurred between what's outside the museum and in the museum, so you start to see the artistry in the world.
So why do you like that? I mean, why are you seeking that?
I think it's the way we experience life. There isn't a boundary, it isn't framed. To marry the everyday experience with the profound. So for me, many things, I'm interested in having something very profound happening next to something very, very, very mundane. So you can look up and see, you know, a volcano go. And then you can look down and you can just see a piece of paint on the floor, and that you should shift between those things. Because I do think a lot of our moments of profundity or moments of joy come at times we least expect.
I mean, the other obvious question is, how do you know when it's finished?
Right.
How do you know when you're done?
For me, when it's done is when it's right at the edge of feeling like it's coming together, but it could also fall apart. It's this teetering moment of change. We're always in that moment, right? We're somewhere between, we have, time is finite for us, we know that. And to highlight, to make that moment of present really powerful as you stand in front of something is I think, is for me, why I am, you know, so interested in seeing art. You know, an artwork is always, it's a time traveler, it's a capsule. It tells us what it means to be human, both in the past, in the present, and potentially what it might be like in the future.
Sarah Z's time-lapse exhibition is up through September 10th. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown at the Guggenheim Museum in New York.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm William Brangham.
And I'm Amna Nawaz in Uvalde, Texas. Join us again tomorrow night when we'll have more from the families of those killed in the elementary school shooting that forever changed this community.
For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you so much for joining us.